Lecture 23, Post-Cold War Spying.
What does treason sound like? What would a double agent say, for instance, after his arrest for betrayal? Words of contrition, self-disgust, self-pity, fear, maybe defiance? Imagine that a spy has just been arrested. FBI agents have swooped in on him just after he had left secret documents in a secret location for his handlers. Just before he got into the red sports car he had bought with money from his betrayal of top secrets. This is not just a lowly spy, but a high-ranking CIA officer who has spied for 9 years and whose betrayal of agents working for America led to the execution of some 10 of those agents. In jail, this man is quoted as boasting, quote, "Over the course of my 9 years of being a KGB mole, I made more money than most crooks, enjoyed myself more, did more interesting things, and during and at the end of those 9 years, accomplished some important things which I believe worthwhile," end quote. You hear in that quote the repetition of more, 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 a compulsion. Fortunately, at least for the purposes of our course, espionage and covert operations did not simply screech to a halt with the end of the Cold War. They went on. In fact, whole new areas of activity opened up and made a bid to take center stage. These included counterterrorism and anxieties about weapons of mass destruction in the wrong hands, economic and corporate espionage, and all the new forms of technological advance that could be used for spying. Satellite technology, cyber warfare, and hacking. We'll address economic espionage and cyber espionage in our next lecture. But in this lecture, we take stock of what has happened in the last 2 decades, roughly, and survey changing challenges and targets of intelligence operations. We'll delve into massive intelligence failures and observe a new dimension in the role of transnational terror networks and non-governmental organizations involved in the secret world. The end of the Cold War gave little rest for American intelligence agencies. There were some who surmised that the collapse of the Soviet Union and the loss of this main enemy, the object of operations for so many years, would be a devastating blow to the CIA, now without a clear mission. In fact, the CIA would have its hands full with more bad news, following on the previous decade's spy scandals, especially in the notorious Year of the Spy, 1985, that we discussed in our previous lecture. In 1994, Aldrich Ames and his wife were arrested as spies, and that's the vignette with which we started this lecture. Ames was one of the CIA's own, a CIA counterintelligence officer who had worked for the CIA for 30 years, but for 9 of those as a double agent, betraying American secrets to the Soviets, and then, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, to the Russian intelligence services. This man did more damage to the CIA than any other case, or at least any other case we know of. Ames was born in 1941 in Wisconsin. His parents were teachers, and his father had gone on to a career with the CIA, as later did his son, apparently carried along more by inertia rather than a commitment to a calling. Ames became an expert on Soviet intelligence. But over time, Ames grew unhappy in his job, feeling that he had stalled out. Now Ames began weighing treason. He argued to himself, perhaps to calm any anxieties of conscience, that the Soviet Union was really not a threat anymore, that it was in fact an opportunity to use. In April 1985, Ames walked into the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. with a stash of secret documents. Months later, he delivered a huge volume of information to his new handlers, including the names of CIA agents in the Soviet Union and details of operations run there, effectively a death sentence for those agents. Eventually, he was paid on the order of $4 million by his handlers. His progress in treason was brisk. It also was not interrupted by the end of the Cold War, because Ames renewed a relationship with the intelligence services of the new Russian Federation. Ames's trademark, however, was reckless behavior. It had been so before, and now increased under the pressure of the secret life he was carrying on. This is one of the perils of tradecraft, by the way. The way in which the secret that one works under, the necessity of maintaining a cover, will eat away at the psychology of an agent forced to work under such circumstances. Ames drank heavily. He was intoxicated in public. At one point, he even lost the operation notes at a CIA picnic in a breach of security. Ames's finances were also clearly out of control, and this should have been a tip-off even to the most passive and trusting colleague. In spite of his modest CIA salary, Ames spent wildly, buying a red Jaguar sports car and paying more than $500,000 in cash for a splendid new house in Arlington, Virginia. His CIA superiors assumed that the wealth that Ames was flinging around must come from his second wife, Rosario, who was from Colombia. But this was not the case. She, however, was helping him in his spying activity. Over the years, Ames was guilty of the most dramatic instances of sloppiness and incompetence, but was not disciplined. After a number of executions of agents for America in the Soviet Union, the search began for an internal traitor. However, in this search, the CIA was slow to coordinate with the FBI, and Ames was able to deflect suspicion from himself by passing polygraph tests. Now, here was the key weakness of lie detection technology. It, in fact, records anxiety rather than the veracity of statements that are being made. And Ames somehow was able to pass with flying colors. Perhaps he somehow lacked the moral inhibitions that ruled those he regarded as lesser mortals below him, as is the way of a psychopath. Ames may simply have been, at the moment, high on his own feelings of being exalted above others, scorning them because he was fooling them. Eventually, however, suspicion did light on Ames, and the FBI tapped his phone, bugged his home and his computer, and found the evidence they needed. In February of 1994, on the day before Ames was to fly to Moscow for a special CIA meeting with their Russian counterparts, the FBI closed in on him and arrested him next to his Jaguar sports car. Ames pleaded guilty and received a life sentence. It's estimated that he had exposed more than 100 secret operations and the identities of more than 30 agents working for the United States or other Western agencies in Eastern Europe or Russia, with about 10 of those executed as a result. The U.S. Congress later passed laws to give American citizenship to the widows and children of those agents whose deaths had been caused by Ames. Only a few years later, another devastating case came to light, which again showcased betrayal for money with some very strange psychological sidelights. Robert Hansen, an FBI agent, used his tradecraft to become first a Soviet and then a Russian agent, turning his expertise in tradecraft against those who had trained him. His caution and cunning allowed him to spy for more than 20 years undetected. Even his Russian handlers did not know who he was, which gave him additional cover and protection. Hansen was born in Chicago in 1944. Soon after joining the FBI, Hansen volunteered his services to GRU, the Soviet military intelligence, in 1979. Apparently, at one point, Hansen's wife found out about his activity, and when she confronted him with it, Hansen said that he had already confessed to a Catholic priest, had ended his spying, and had donated his ill-gotten gains. But then, in 1985, after a hiatus in his espionage activities, Hansen started up again. He sent a letter to a KGB officer whom he knew of in the Soviet embassy in Washington. In this strangely officious and bureaucratically worded letter, Hansen arranged to send to the Soviets valuable secret documents in exchange for $100,000. Hansen never met his KGB paymasters. His communications to them were signed Ramon Garcia. The KGB, who, as I've mentioned, did not know his identity, nor even the fact that he was an FBI agent, came to believe that Hansen must be a CIA agent because of those last letters in the name Garcia, CIA, in this pseudonym. This is astonishing. Here's a double agent who fooled even his own handlers in that sense. In the years that followed, Hansen passed nuclear strategy documents, military technology secrets, and the identities of American agents, two of whom were executed as a result. As in the case of Ames, in spite of sloppy and incompetent work at Hansen's cover job, he was never disciplined by a bureaucracy that he managed to navigate with tremendous cunning. Increasingly, however, the FBI suspected that something must be awry. The betrayal of agents suggested there was some crisis internal to their own operations. But the FBI concentrated on theories that involved technical problems, such as intercepted FBI electronic communications or broken codes as the culprit, rather than Hansen. And so this is a fascinating moment in tradecraft. It was the high estimation of the importance of SIGINT, or signals intelligence, that in this case allowed a human agent, a humint factor, to pass by unobserved. Now, it's very difficult, perhaps impossible, to say what was going on in the head of a man such as Hansen. At work and in public, he presented himself as a devout Catholic, while privately living a very different kind of life, making sex tapes to show a friend, and patronizing an exotic dancer whom he showered with expensive gifts. At long last, it was a tip from a former Soviet agent that pinpointed Hansen. And in 2001, as Hansen was leaving documents at a dead drop in a Virginia park, leaving the documents under a bridge, the FBI swooped in and arrested him. As they did so, as they took him into custody, Hansen said something very strange. He said, "What took you so long?" What did this mean? Was this an expression of Hansen's relief at finally ending a long and weary double life of deception? Was it another typically officious and snarky complaint about the inefficiency of the government that he himself had served? What do you think he meant by that statement? It has also been suggested that what Hansen, in fact, was expressing was his desire to be caught, because only in that way could his own self-believed greatness as a spy be revealed. Ironically, if he hadn't been found out, his achievements would never have been known, and thus his self-deluding fantasies would never have been realized. One last fascinating detail that I want to note here as well is that the indicted spy, Hansen, explained, in terms of his motivations, that he had always wanted to spy after reading one particular book. Can you guess which book that was? It was Kim Philby's Odd Manifesto about being an unrepentant betrayer, My Silent War, published in 1968. Hansen's secret struggle, at least, was finally over. The decade after the end of the Cold War also brought further intelligence failures for American agencies that were of their own making, not the product of greedy moles within. The international ramifications of these failures were crucial. First, in 1999, NATO intervened in the Balkans. Yugoslavia, under the Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic, was engaged in a brutal crackdown on Albanians in the territory of Kosovo as a coda to the years of brutal ethnic cleansing that had accompanied the breakup of the multinational Yugoslav state. NATO forces now struck at strategic assets in the capital, Belgrade, to force an end to the crackdown in Kosovo. And in the process, it was the CIA that provided targeting information to NATO bombers. The CIA indicated a building in the downtown that was said to house military communications equipment of the Yugoslav army. The bomb struck, and then the building turned out to have been the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. Three workers were killed inside. Quite predictably, relations between China and the United States underwent a crisis. How could such a mistake be made? A larger intelligence failure came on September 11, 2001, with an undetected attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden. Four hijacked planes, loaded with passengers, were steered by terrorists on a mission of spectacular destruction. Two of them hit the World Trade Center towers in New York, another crashed into the Pentagon in Washington, and a fourth smashed up on impact in Pennsylvania on its way to another target. This was the greatest nightmare of the CIA and other American intelligence agencies. Remember that their charter mission had been no more Pearl Harbors, no more bolts from the blue. And yet, Al-Qaeda had planned and executed an attack that killed thousands of Americans on American soil. What was markedly different about this attack was that it was not mounted by a state, but by a non-governmental group, a radical terror network. In 1996, Osama bin Laden, leader of Al-Qaeda, which means the base, had issued a declaration of holy war against the West. This son of a prosperous family in Saudi Arabia had already been active in Central Asia, recruiting fighters for the war in Afghanistan against the Soviets. From 1998, when Al-Qaeda had bombed U.S. embassies in Africa, the CIA had been targeting bin Laden. But several attempts to capture or kill him either failed or were called off. In part, the 1999 targeting mistake that I just mentioned in Yugoslavia haunted the planners and urged on them extreme caution. Then, in 2001, Al-Qaeda struck to devastating effect. The investigative commission, which studied the mistakes that led to the 9/11 intelligence failure, concluded that problems included so-called stovepiping of information, so that different parts of the American intelligence bureaucracy did not effectively communicate with each other and share data. Also important was the failure to imagine what the attacks could look like, the new forms that they might take. In the aftermath of the attacks, the United States and British allies invaded Afghanistan, where bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had been hosted by the Taliban radical Islamist regime. The war was launched in October 2001, but while the Taliban were toppled, bin Laden was not caught, and the fighting continued for many years. Some commentators worried about a particular dimension of this struggle, the role of Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI. In neighboring Pakistan, the ISI, or Inter-Services Intelligence, had earlier had ties with the Taliban. What would the role of the ISI be in this fight? American policy next turned to Iraq. Iraq, under its ruler Saddam Hussein, had not been directly linked to the 9/11 attacks. Concern over Iraq instead focused on reports by different Western intelligence agencies that Hussein had an ongoing program to produce weapons of mass destruction. There are also questions about his long-range ambitions in the region and the nature of his regime, but in particular, anxieties about weapons of mass destruction. This belief looked back to the aftermath of the first Gulf War in 1991, after which it had been revealed that Iraq had chemical and biological weapons programs and had been working on a nuclear weapon. What was unclear was where things stood around 2002, as the UN weapons inspections process had been frustrated by Hussein after 1995. The American 2002 National Intelligence Estimate judged that Iraq had so-called WMD programs, including chemical and biological weapons, and might be working on a nuclear weapon. In the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, British Prime Minister Tony Blair and U.S. President George Bush invoked the threat of WMD in making their public case for taking action now. Other strategic reasons were advanced as well, but the threat of WMD had most immediacy. The invasion of Iraq began in March 2003, and in a month, Hussein's regime was toppled. But massive WMD projects were not found. Possibly, Hussein may have wanted his foes, external and internal, to believe that he still possessed the capabilities, even though the earlier programs had not been reactivated. The intelligence on WMD had been partial, contradictory, and unclear. One case apparently involved a forged document, which had been passed along by Italian intelligence, purporting to show Iraqi purchases of uranium yellowcake in Niger. This was a renewed lesson of tradecraft that intelligence needs to be confirmed by multiple independent sources, not only through a small handful of informants. More broadly, since the launching of what President George Bush called a war on terror after 9/11, the CIA and American intelligence agencies were subject to considerable controversy over the conduct of this counterterrorism. There was and continues to be much debate over interrogation techniques, the status of prisoners, how they should be detained and tried or released. The revelation of the existence of secret prisons run by the CIA in European countries and other countries around the world, so-called black sites, prompted further controversy. They were called black sites because there the existence and the presence of these prisoners was not publicly known. Their identities would remain secret as well as the interrogations they were subjected to. It was revealed that the CIA secretly flew suspects for interrogation to secret prisons that had been set up abroad, and hence black or unknown. There have been press reports suggesting that some of these were in Eastern European or East Asian countries, but few foreign governments have been eager to identify themselves as having cooperated. Vigorous criticism and the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission led to changes in the CIA and how American intelligence is structured. In 2004, for instance, the position of Director of National Intelligence was established, as urged by the 9/11 Commission, as a new overall coordinating post. With the dissolution of the Office of the Director of Central Intelligence in 2005, the CIA's earlier centrality had been displaced. This was a watershed in the history of the CIA. If American intelligence activities and organizations were being restructured under the pressure of a global confrontation with terrorism, we need to note the changes taking place to what had been the great Cold War opponent, the Soviet Union's KGB. As the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, an important symbolic act took place. The large black statue of Iron Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the CK, which had stood outside the Lubyanka prison and KGB headquarters in downtown Moscow, was lifted off of its pedestal with a crane and taken down as crowds cheered. The KGB was restructured to become the intelligence service of the Russian Federation. The FSB, or Federalnaya Služba Bezopasnosti, the Federal Security Service, now handled internal security in Russia, while the SVR, or Foreign Intelligence Service, handled espionage. What had not changed was the important role of the security services in Russian politics. Indeed, officials of what they themselves call the higher police have made a potent comeback and occupy leading positions in Russia today in a striking continuity with Soviet times. This is most evident in the career of Vladimir Putin in Russia. After a long career as a KGB official, including his duties as a liaison in Dresden, Germany, then he served with the FSB. In 1999, Putin became prime minister under President Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin suddenly resigned in 1999 and left Putin as acting president. Putin was then elected president in 2000. He was elected in part on the wave of fears of Chechen terrorism inside Russia, which he promised to crack down on powerfully. In September 1999, there had been a spate of bombings of apartment buildings in Moscow and other cities attributed to Chechen terrorists. Inside Russia and abroad, however, some observers voiced the suspicion that these bombings were a government pretext for a crackdown. They pointed to a strange incident in the Russian city of Ryazan. In that city, a bus driver spotted a suspicious car parked next to his own apartment building. And when local police investigated, they found sacks of white powder and a timing device in the basement of that building. The building was evacuated, and the sacks tested positive in a test for explosives. But the next day, security officials from Moscow announced publicly that this had actually been a civil defense test and that the sacks contained merely sugar. For the residents of Ryazan, this raised more questions than it answered. What to believe? In the years that followed, Putin served as president, then as prime minister since 2008, turning Russia in a direction that he called managed democracy, steered by state officials. Beyond Russia's internal politics, Eastern European politics have also unfortunately seen continuities with Cold War days in attacks on political targets. On September 5, 2004, the Ukrainian opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko went to dinner with the deputy head of the Ukrainian intelligence service. Later that evening, Yushchenko became desperately ill. Medical tests showed dioxin poisoning symptoms. The symptoms were visible on his bloated, pockmarked face. In spite of this, Yushchenko was elected, in part on a wave of sympathy, as president of Ukraine. Who had done it? Was the intention to kill him outright? Or was the intention to disfigure him publicly in his outward appearance and thus scuttle his chances for election? A worse mile marker in espionage was reached in 2006, the first nuclear assassination by radiation. In 2006, Alexander Litvinenko, a former KGB and later FSB agent, was living in London. He had been living in exile for 6 years. Litvinenko was public in his fierce criticism of Putin and the direction which Russia was taking. Litvinenko had been born in 1962 in Voronezh. After military service, he had joined the KGB in 1988. When the KGB, after the fall of the Soviet Union, became the FSB, Litvinenko was assigned to a branch investigating corruption within the FSB itself. He was dismissed from the FSB when he claimed in 1998 that he had been ordered to kill political opponents of the Russian government. Then Litvinenko was arrested, but later acquitted. He fled Russia in the year 2000, traveling to Britain to seek political asylum with his family, and he gained British citizenship in 2006. In a book which he published, he claimed that the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings had actually been the work of the FSB. Litvinenko also blamed the government for the killing of the Russian independent journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who had criticized the conduct of the Russian war in Chechnya. Then, in November 2006, after lunch in a sushi restaurant in London, Litvinenko suddenly and mysteriously was taken ill. He died a lingering death weeks later on November 23rd. Tests found that he had been poisoned with polonium-210. Speculation as to who was responsible pointed in many directions. The Kremlin and the Russian government. Litvinenko himself made this accusation as he lay dying for 3 agonizing weeks. Or perhaps rogue former KGB agents or the Russian mafia. This tragic scene opened up large questions. Even after the Cold War had ended, what continuities in politics and espionage might lie hidden beneath the surface? The crime of Litvinenko's murder was a blending of the old and new, an ancient tool, poison, but in a cutting-edge technological form as a radioactive toxin. Did this point in the direction which espionage and covert action would take in the future? We'll confront this question of future espionage in our next and final lecture.